Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. Is there anybody who is new? So basically, format is sort of simple. This is what's called a Dharma talk. I think this morning we have a children's program, so we'll end a little earlier, and they will come in and they will present to us what they've been up to. And again, usually what they've been up to is a lot more interesting and fun than what we've been up to. But unfortunately, we're too old for that program. So I wanted to begin this morning just sharing with you, since not everybody was able to be there, but a very, kind of a meaningful moment that we had on Thursday night. Some of you were there with the Lama? Yeah, so some were there, but most weren't. So there is this Tibetan Lama. He used to be a monk for many years, but now he's not, who lives in the States, who has been for the last 2 weeks at the St. Pete Museum of Fine Arts, erecting this sand mandala. Sand mandala is an art, a sacred art within the Tibetan Buddhist community that is usually done in connection to these quite elaborate initiations that go on for weeks. And there are many parts of it, and part of it is this creation out of sand, of this very geometric, elaborate mandala. All made from colored sand. It's quite intricate. So anyhow, this Lama has been doing this since the early 80s, originally as a monk, but he's really continued it on as a kind of a demonstration of this sacred art form. And I think he does it to just allow people to be aware of the Tibetan community and its traditions. So anyhow, I had been out of town, but I heard when I got back in town last week that he was doing it, and I was in St. Pete on Tuesday, went over there, saw what he was up to, and just had a few moments with him, said we had a center here, would he like to come give a Dharma talk? He said, of course. So he came over here on Thursday night. I was able to have a dinner with him beforehand. It was quite a... it took him an hour and a half to get here. Traffic on a Thursday night, so it was quite wonderful that he made it. And then he gave a talk, and it was actually, we did about 20 minutes of meditation first, and he gave a talk which was actually quite brief, for those who were here, surprisingly brief. But yet, I think that made it all the more meaningful. And there were a couple of things that he said that struck me that I want to share with you, comment on. Actually, interesting enough, when we were having dinner beforehand, he had been in a monastery for over 20 years in Dharamsala, which is a center for Tibetan refugees in India, and the home of the Dalai Lama. And he had been in the he had been a monastic in the monastery that is kind of attached to the Dalai Lama, and we were talking, and I mentioned that I had been there, studying there in the mid-70s, and he asked me who I'd been studying with, and I mentioned some of the teachers, and he immediately put his hands like this at the mention of their names. It was really, it's almost like he missed it up, and he, just thinking of them, just moved him. You know, I mean, these are both teachers who have been dead, for many years, and you know, he might not have thought about in many years. This is 75, 40 years ago, so it was a while ago. But anyhow, and he did comment that to me, oh, those were the golden years, and they certainly were. For me, I was very fortunate to have been there in those years, because there were so many wonderful masters who had come out of Tibet as refugees, and they were just very accessible. Just walk in and ask him for a teaching practice. I mean, it was as simple as that in those days. So when he gave his talk, he began his talk, and he really, very humbly, I think, I can't remember his exact words, but he remembered he really kind of looked to the Buddha, sort of like, this is the real one, I'm not. And he mentioned, about the great masters, and he really was very clear that he is not one of those. And he thanked us for inviting him here tonight and meditating with him. They said, this is very beneficial for me. So it was quite, and I think he was very moved by coming here, to be actually, in the things he said, because to see a center like this, kind of an American center, kind of building, creating this thing all by ourselves without any external help, he was very deeply moved. He was reflecting, for those who remember, he said when he first came here as part of the one of the Dalai Lama's first tours to America, I think in 1981, he said they were at the airport and they were kind of going through the airport, and they would hear people kind of looking at them and pointing and going, "Oh, Hare Krishna," when they saw the Dalai Lama. Those of you who go back several decades sort of remember in the 60s and 70s, the Hare Krishna people were fairly ubiquitous in airports and other kinds of public gathering with their distinctive look. And sort of, obviously, many people in those days, that was kind of, we were all lumped into one, including the Dalai Lama. So he was quite, he said, things have certainly changed in the last 30, 40 years in terms of Americans' understanding of Buddhism, appreciating of Buddhism, and just really the way meditation and mindfulness have really entered our culture. And he did talk about, the Dalai Lama's interest in science, and how he spends much of the time in the last decade, several decades, really meeting with scientists and really looking, for the unified basis of Buddhist teachings with modern science. But there were a couple other things that touched me. The thing I think that touched me the most was he talked about his experience at the museum. And to be honest with you, when I had gone that morning, and I was he was in the center. I don't know, did some people go to the museum? Yeah, so some people have gone and seen it. But when I was there on a Tuesday morning, he's kind of there, and it's a very precise, I mean, they do it with these little very narrow funnels, and it's a very precise, they come down to this tiny edge. I mean, if you can imagine a very intricate painting all done with colored sand. I mean, it's quite, and it's not only it's three-dimensional. So there's I mean, it's quite. So anyhow, so there he is, set up in the central atrium, and just people are coming by all the time and talking to him, and I observed him doing that, and then people would like would you take your picture with me? And he was constantly being, and people would and he'd smile, and and they'd put his arm around him. And I observed this for about a half an hour. And to be honest with you, I've reflected myself, either this man gets paid a lot to do this, or this is really about selflessness, because he was just so, he just talked to them as long as they talked to and do whatever they want. And as soon as they, then he got back to work. But I didn't say anything to him when we were downstairs about that. And then on his own, he started talking about doing these sand paintings in museums. And he mentions how he's there. And he said, and then someone will come by and they'll say to me, they'll ask me, where did the sand come from? They'll answer them, and then they'll ask him, and how do you color the sand? And then similar questions like that. And then the person would walk on, he'd get back to work. And then he said 5 minutes later, somebody would come along and ask him, where do you get the sand from? And next they'd ask him, and how do you color it? And then they'd walk on, and a few minutes later, somebody else would come by, and they'd say, But where do you get the sand from? And how do you color it? And he goes on like this, describing kind of his day, you know. And then he said, I thought it was a wonderful thing. He said, at a certain point, I thought to myself, I should just get a T-shirt, right? That says, you know, I got the sand here, and I color it, and this is how I color it, right? Practical, right? And, but then he said, but then I thought to myself, and I thought of my teachers, and he said, and I remembered that I am just here to serve. I am just here to serve beings. And if they have questions, it is my job to answer them. It was quite wonderful. I mean, and then he said, and as soon as they're done and they move on, he said, I immediately, you know, he sort of went like this. He said, and then I get back to the San Madala and I'm just like that, right? Just totally focused and present. And again, I think in that little anecdote, right, that he shared about his life, I think he touched a very deep aspect of this practice. And really sort of practice of Dharma in real life, right? And how it was seamless, you see, it was seamless. When he was engaged in activity with human beings, he only had one thought, right? To be of service, to be of help, to be of benefit. That was his only thought. He was clear. He didn't think, do I want to do this? Do I not want to do this? Do I have to say this again? Do I have to put up with this person? Do I have to, you know? That's where most of us are in the world. Right? We're always kind of annoyed with anything that gets in the way of our own agenda. Right? But he really showed what a deep practitioner he was, because his only agenda was to be of benefit. And no matter what way the activities moved or shifted, right, he always just responded to them. And I saw him in action. I mean, he was just very sweet and pleasant and interested in people. And then again, as soon as he moved on, and as he said it, as soon as he moved on, right back to the practice, right, of presence. But his practice of presence wasn't only on the sand mandala. When he was with people, he was practicing presence. Right? So it was a very, I found it, you know, a wonderful teaching, a live teaching. You know, it wasn't just a theoretical teaching. He was talking about how to do it, and I think the way he does it is wonderful. Actually, it reminds me, and maybe I've shared this before, of an experience I had many years ago when I was in India, so somewhat similar about kind of not having your own agenda. I was in Bodh Gaya, which is where the Buddha came to enlightenment. This was in the mid-70s. And I was staying then, I was there for a month, and I stayed, I was living in the Japanese monastery. And there was a Japanese monk who lived there. And it was, if you go to Bodh Gaya, all the Buddhist countries have their own temples, but also they like the Japanese had a guest house. So when Japanese Buddhists came on pilgrimage, they would have a Japanese kind of place to stay in. So the monk there at the Japanese temple was a Zen monk, and there was an area in front of the monastery or the temple. That he had a little Japanese garden. You know what a Japanese garden? You know, these little rock pebble gardens. And every day, and they have these kind of special breaks, he'd be out there, you know, making the swirls and, you know, making the little rivers. And, you know, every morning he would do it just right. Right? And then the day would proceed and all the tourists and people would come and they'd walk right over it. Right? Just walk right over it. You know, people didn't have a clue what it was. They just, you know, just a gravel something. He walked right over it. And I observed this for a while, and I observed him, you know, the next morning out there. And one day, being a very practical person, and I said to the sensei, I said, "Sensei, you know, I see what you do every day. But again, you know, we're in India, and people in India know nothing about Japanese gardens, right? You know, it's not like they're doing this on purpose, but they know nothing about Japanese gardens. So I, you know, why don't we just put up a little fence, right? Just look, or like kind of a little barrier, so people just won't walk over it, or maybe put a little sign, Japanese garden. You know what I'm saying? I thought this was a very practical response, and you know, oh, kind of a win-win situation. And he looked at me and he said, no, Fred. He said, "I have to keep doing this until I get it just right. When I get it just right, they'll notice it." Right? Wow. Very different way, right, than our everyday usual mind, isn't it? Right? It's not their fault. It's me. Right? I haven't got it just perfect yet. And so every day I'm willing to go out there and just keep working it. Right? So that was the first anecdote. The other thing, and again, I'd never heard it before. He said it as if this is a common metaphor in Buddhist meditation, but I'd never heard it. Very simple. He also mentioned, you know, we had done 20 or 25 minutes of meditation earlier before he talked, and, you know, we had done meditation like here, mindfulness, it was quiet meditation. And then he said, you know, that kind of, he talked about doing meditation earlier, and you know, that we'd done together, and how wonderful that is for quieting and calming the mind. I mean, I'm just using my own words. I don't remember his words, but then he said, you know, there's more to Buddhist meditation than that, and he used the metaphor of, he said, it would be like, if this roof had a little hole in it, right, in the rainy season, and that every time it rained, a little drops of water would come down. And so, you know, so what we would do, we would get a pot, right, and put it under that that drip. And then by the end of the day, the pot would be full, and we would take it out, right, dump it outside and bring it back in, and the next day, drip, 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 drip. And at the end of the day, we would, you know, take that. And this would work, wouldn't it? But he said, Buddhist meditation is about looking for the cause and fixing that. So you don't have to every day take out the water. You don't have to keep a pot in the middle of the meditation hall. Right? And this is very significant, and it really, and when what he said is, you know, Buddhist meditation is really about the realization of the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the path that leads to the end of suffering. Again, something for us all to remember. Many people have their daily meditation practice. Many people have their daily spiritual practice. Many people have their practices they do. But it's really mostly just about always emptying the water. And then the next day we just fill it up again, right? And then the next day we fill it up again. And so in a certain way, we introduce meditation into our lives, but in the context of the drip, right? And now we've learned a way to kind of empty it out so it doesn't overflow, right? So through our practice of Buddhism, Dharma, mindfulness, meditation, or other spiritual practice you do, we've kind of made sure that it doesn't overflow anymore. It doesn't do the damage it used to do, right? But we're still not really taking care of the leak, We still are not looking deeply into the sources. Why do I have this agitated mind? Right? Why do I still have emotional ups and downs? Why do I still have the storms of emotionality riding through me? Right? Why do I still get angry, anxious, sad? Right? Why do I still find myself in conflict with other people? Why aren't I really happy and at peace? Right? So I thought that was a good reminder for all of us, and I like that that we have to remember again. If it's leaking and we can put a pot under it and kind of take care of it that way, well, we're taking care of it, right? It's not ruining the floor. But we still haven't really looked deeply to the source of the leak, because once that leak is taken care of, what? The whole thing with the pots and every day and having to empty it out, we don't have to do that anymore, do we? And so it was a good reminder that the Buddhist path, the spiritual path, is about change, is about transformation. You know, many people, spirituality, they love these things with the pupae becoming the larvae, becoming the cocoon, becoming the what? The butterfly, right? People love it. There are all kind of little posters around that we love to use that. Yeah, that's what this is about. But please remember, what is that about? It starts out looking like a what? What? And it ends up looking like a what? And you look at that, and you look at that, and you go, that's totally different. Right? And yet, if you watch the process, you see the process, how this transforms into that. But that is very different than this. Siddhartha, when he lived in the palace, and Siddhartha, when he became the Buddha, very different. Healed, transformed, awakened, enlightened. No longer was his meditation about calming down, because he no longer was agitated. Right? No longer was he using his meditation to work through his issues. He didn't have any issues. Is that clear? So it's important to remember that this is, I mean, it's still, the work goes on every day. But again, in the same way, we could say that little cocoon, you know, if we had the slow motion photography, we would see that every day it is changing. Right, but still, remember that where it began and where it ends up is radically different. So anyhow, he was nice to have. I'm sure everybody who saw him benefited from him, but I did want to share that with everybody. We had a very nice encounter here. He actually he does have a Buddhist community or a group in Philadelphia. And they just actually just bought sounds like a warehouse or something, but a totally empty space. So he was, he and his students were taking lots of notes as they walked around here. But hopefully he really wanted to come back next year. Maybe we'll have him for a few days and he'll teach. Yeah, so I think it'll be wonderful. Any questions about that? So please remember his practice. Yes?
I think I understand the difference, but you just contrast a little bit between sort of metaphors of raking the garden and the bucket example.
They were different. Yeah, I was connecting the the raking to the one about his sand and not, just not, that he just did that. He didn't have any attachment to outcome. It was all about his practice. Is that clear? It's about his practice. You know, let me just continue from that, okay? Is that clear? So that was in relation to that one, not into the bucket. Okay? So if you didn't see the connection, I mean, I could probably try to make one, but I'm not feeling too sharp this morning, so I don't know. But, you know, we have been over these months, and we'll be continuing. We have a retreat coming up Thursday, and then a new intensive. But we've been looking into these Lojong, or these mind trainings slogans. And the one I want to talk about this morning, is actually the last one of these 58 slogans. And it sort of ties in a little bit to his visit, which quite reads here in this translation, "Don't expect thanks." Other people have translated it as "don't expect rewards," "don't expect applause," "don't expect gratitude." Okay. And this is the final one. And it's interesting because earlier, and I think I've commented, maybe other people have over these months, there is this other wonderful slogan says, "Be grateful to everyone." Right? But over here it says, "Don't expect gratitude." Right? So in the beginning, be grateful to everyone. At the end, don't expect gratitude. So I think this is sort of like in the world of you know, we talk about active and passive, sort of that which one does and that which one receives, right? So in this world, with all that goes on, usually we are, you know, I think people understand that being grateful is a good thing. Actually, these people do research on gratitude, and they find that people who make gratitude lists and all these kinds of things actually are happier people. Or if you're not happy, you can become a happier person. And make, you know, so these are what social psychologists do. And they have researched very clearly that becoming a more grateful person, more consciously grateful person, even just simply, as I say, just making lists and starting off your day that way is healthy, mentally healthy, emotionally healthy. But long before modern social psychology, there was the Dharma. And said, be grateful to everyone and everything. Again, that slogan is to cut through the ego, the I, me, mine, the self, that is quite willing to be grateful when and in gratitude when people do things for me. Right? We have no problem. I mean, there are totally selfish people who even when, right? But for most people, when somebody does something for us or does what we want, we say what? Thank you. So we are grateful. So that slogan of be grateful to everyone or everything is really to break out of that into the rest of experience. Experiences that we are neutral to, or most importantly, experiences that we are aversive to. We don't like aversive people, aversive situations, or just situations that aren't going our way. People are making decisions that we don't think that we want them to make, or somebody's doing something that we don't want them to do, or people saying something to me. You know, it's like, oh, can I be grateful for that? And why be grateful for that? Because, again, because we're looking now at our own transformation. To break up the world into that which I'm grateful for and that which I am antagonistic to creates what within me? Disquiet, conflict, emotional ups and downs. Right? But to be able to approach the world in all situations with gratitude. When things go my way, you know, in Zen they say, when things go your way, you put your hands together. When things don't go your way, you put your hands together in gratitude. No difference. Now, how can you be grateful to when things aren't going your way? Because when things aren't going our way is our opportunity to transform. To transform. To let go. To see that my ideas about how things should be and how life should be proceeding or how this situation should be or how people should be or how I should be treated is nothing other than my own ego, right? And when somebody treats me poorly, says things about me, when things don't go my way, when I have an aversive situation, there is no better time to wake up and transform than that moment, right? So Thich Nhat Hanh once said, if we are not grateful, we suffer. I think everybody in here knows what that means. If we're not in a state of gratitude, a state of acceptance, you know, a state of thank you, then our minds will be, in conflict. And our relationship to beings will not be open. And we will not have the capacity to really see the benefit that is coming to me in this situation, which is why the great Buddhist teacher Shantideva, and many of you who've studied him know, he says, yes, on your altar, half of it for the Buddha, half of it for your enemies. Why? Because he said, it is your enemies, and this is means anybody who gives you a hard time, it is these people that are really allowing you to learn how to be understanding and compassionate, right? Because it's a stretch, right? We have to work at it. People treating us nice is easy, right? Coming in and bowing to the Buddha, that's easy. Look at him, sitting there peacefully, right? Not saying anything negative to us, not being judgmental, you know what I mean? Right? We bow to him, right? But if you think of the person who gives you the hardest time in the world, the person that you wish was not in your life or not in the world, and if you put them up here, what would that be like? You bow to them for different reasons than you bow to the Buddha. But you bow to them for good reasons. So, on the other hand, on one hand, we have be grateful to everyone and everything, and yet then we have at the very last slogan saying, don't expect gratitude. Right? So now we're talking inwardly. Right? When I am the receiver, because when I, again, in the world of ego, when I do something for somebody else, what do I want? At the very least, I want a what? What? A thank you. I can't believe they never said thank you. Unbelievable. Right? So at the very least, we expect a what? A thank you. I mean, we would love to have what? A card. We would love to have a little public recognition. Wouldn't we? We would love to know that this person told other people about what kind of good person we were, this wonderful thing we did. I mean, we'd love it to get around, wouldn't we? Right? But all that does is what? It builds up our ego. And it ends up doing good deeds for all the wrong reasons. Don't look for gratitude. Don't look for applause. Don't look for thanks. Because, again, Jerry, see, why was he doing that thing? For himself. To perfect his own practice, his own being. Right? Why does the Lama not be a very practical guy? You know, put on a t-shirt, or at least have a little card, right? Kind of explaining this is what it is, and this is where I got the sand from, and this is how I color it, and just, oh, thank you, you know, and just give him a card. Why does he go through it hundreds or thousands of times? He must have gone through it tens of thousands of times, just to see how many times I saw him in an hour. And he was there for 2 weeks. Why does he just give out a card? Can you see why? Because it's his practice. And every time he gets lazy, or every time he gets annoyed, or every time he gets weary, oh, not again. There's that same stupid question again. He doesn't do that. He just, I'm here to serve. I'm here to serve. So this slogan about not expecting reward, again, is wonderful. It allows us to act in an altruistic way in the world without expecting anything in return. Right? Altruism for its own sake. Goodness for its own sake. That is transformative. Now again, you know, there is a developmental model for somebody who's very selfish, right? And totally thinks everything should come to them, then probably learning to say thank you is probably developmentally a good step up, isn't it, on the path. But now we're talking about people who perhaps have already taken that step, but now are attached to the applause, to being noticed, to wanting the thank yous. And how do we know we're attached? Two ways. One, when we don't get it, how do we feel? Annoyed, at the very least. Right? We're annoyed. We're angry. And oftentimes it also leads to judgments. That's so-and-so, critical, judgmental mind. So we see where it leads to. Right? And we want to be free of that. Right? And we want to act from a place of goodness within ourselves. Right, actually, in Buddhism, and I think it actually—I'm not sure where it might have even come earlier than Buddhism. Maybe in China, Taoism, and it's similar to what I'm saying. It's a concept of hidden virtue, where actually it is a practice, like in Zen monastery, the place. It is a practice to do something for someone else. And to really be secretive about it, right? You know what I'm saying? You'd be very secretive, right? Maybe they all leave their shoes when they come in the monastery in place, and you'd find somebody's shoes, and you'd take them to your room, and you'd clean them up, or you'd repair them, right? And then you'd put them back. Never say anything, right? We go into the kitchen and we see somebody has left their dishes in the sink. Usually our response is what? Complain. Why don't we just do the dishes? Not say anything. It's hard. We want to say something. So hidden virtue is a wonderful practice. We just do things for people secretly. It's a practice because it forces us to do something without any sense of any kind of recognition or acknowledgement. The practice of hidden virtue is a very powerful practice. So be grateful to everyone. Don't expect thanks. Don't expect applause. And even, you know, do things under the radar. Again, your Buddha nature will be very happy. Your ego nature will struggle. We want to struggle. If everything's easy and calm, we're not practicing. We want to be challenged. We want to be a little uncomfortable. How do we know we're practicing well? We're uncomfortable a lot. Is that clear? If you think everything's wonderful and you're a great spiritual practitioner, I don't know what dharma you're practicing. It's probably just your self-dharma that's kind of feeling very good about itself, giving itself lots of applause, right? So when nobody applauds me, I'll applaud myself, right? Why not? The kids come in at 4:15? Yeah. So what comes to mind is... in our community, you know, everything, for those of you who are new or not part of the community, who just maybe come on Sunday, everything that goes on here is done by members. The creation of this place, the transformation of this place, all the sittings, the conducting, everything we do, all the activities of our community, the mindfulness, everything, the retreats, the intensives, the days of mindfulness, the Mindfulness Institute, the classes, everything is done by members on a volunteer basis. And we are fortunate to have many, 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 many people who volunteer in many ways. And actually, I didn't like the word volunteers. It reminded me too much of, that kind of volunteering at a nonprofit, which people can do for many reasons. To me, it was really, again, about practice of selfless service. But within the realm of selfless service, again, it's not always the way it looks on the outside. It's really ultimately about what is in the mind of the person who's doing the action. That's always the key thing in Buddhism, because at the end of the day, it is about transformation of my mind. That's why I am doing this. I'm not just doing it just to get the job done. I'm doing it to get the job of transformation done. And in the world even of service within our own community, I want to use Angie, our executive director, who's somebody who I've been able to observe over the years. And even though so many people in this room, do service above and beyond. But what I most appreciate about Angie is not only is she the hardest working person in our community, and I'm probably the least hardest working person in this community, so I can say that, but she does things that if you asked her, she would not want to do. You know, many of us, we volunteer, but we volunteer for things we like doing. Right? Oh, I like what? I like cleaning, or, some people do like cleaning, by the way. I like cleaning, or I like cooking, or I like teaching, or I like setting up, or I like mentoring. We do a lot of mentoring of new members, so I enjoy. So there are many things that we do here. Evelyn probably likes doing yoga, right? And that's all good. I mean, those are all contributions, but it pushes us, right, to do things that the self says, oh, I don't want to do that. And if there's one thing I've observed about Angie over these years, she does everything, and she does the things that nobody else wants to do. And that is, that is admirable. Again, I don't know within her own mind whether she's secretly gritting her teeth or not. That is, that's between that, that's between her and the Buddha. But again, I think that is admirable. And not to seek attention, not to seek applause, and just to, there have been so many over the course of years here, especially with the construction and the building and the subcontractors and permitting problems and all. If anybody's ever done their own little remodeling project, you know what that's like. And if you want to maybe times that by 100, you get a sense of what this thing's been like. And Angie has been willing, I look at Sam, I look at Alex, there are other people who've done the dirty work. We have the ability to appreciate their labors, but there are people who do the dirty work, right? And we should be grateful to them. And I just want to say that I am deeply grateful. And I just use as an example be great, we should be grateful to everyone. And we should be grateful to everything. And when we walk in this hall, we should go, oh, thank you, all the people who did this. But I can just walk in here. This beautiful hall. And I'm saying this because it was just interesting to see the Lama and his two students when he was here on Thursday. He was just going like, wow, this is so beautiful. I can't believe you did this all by yourself. No support from the Dalai Lama? I mean, no. No support from Thich Nhat Hanh? No. No support from anyone? No. We just did it all by ourselves. As my grandson Leo says, do it myself. We did it ourselves, and it's really, we should be always grateful. We should be grateful to everything, but we should especially be grateful in this world to people who do the hard things, the dirty things. I remember once coming here a year ago, and what was it? The sewage was backing up down in the kitchen, right? I'm talking about raw sewage backing up in the drains in the kitchen, right? Messy, stinky, foul. Sam got down there and took care of him. I bow to you, Sam. So we should always be grateful. We should always be grateful to the, they're doing the roads at night. I'm heading home 9 o'clock and these guys are going to work, right? On the roads, asphalt, it's like not easy work, is it? And we bow to them, right? We bow to all the people who work so hard in this world and don't have it easy and get dirty, get tired. Yeah, we should not forget. So, any comments or questions? We have about 5 minutes. Anything in your hearts? Yes, Liz.
When the Lama spoke, he talked about when he was talking about how he wanted to wear the thing about the stand on his shirt and when he put himself in service. I immediately thought of how many times throughout my kid's life I thought, when he flashed cards, he could just go. And how many times I've actually said to them, oh, I've said this 100 times already. and then very irritating.
Right, there you go.
And when you said that, I thought, oh, what a shift.
What a shift.
Really practice being able to see parenting as the self-service that it is.
Right, there you
go. As opposed to feeling as though once I teach, you should just get it.
Right.
that was really very touching for me, too. But it was beautiful.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's really when we see our whole life, our relationships of all types and our work as something no different than our practice. It's all about cultivating selflessness, learning to be present, learning to let go of self, right? And then when it's that way, it's right. It's all those, and that's what he said, where he was getting annoyed, and realized, get the flashcards or get the T-shirt. And he said, no, this is my practice. And you're exactly right. With our children, with our parents, with our loved ones, with our work colleagues, with our society, learning to be patient. And again, it's about me. This is an opportunity for me to practice patience. It's an opportunity for me to let go. It's an opportunity for me to put somebody else's need ahead of my own. Because obviously in those moments, your children have a need. Right? But usually again, and we all can relate to you, Liz, we make it about who? Not about them, we make it about me. As if somehow we have so many important things to do other than be present to our children. Right? I mean, what could be more important than that? And yet we have all the things we need to do and got to get this email out or got to do this. Rather than going, no, there's nothing more important I have to do. The email can go out a little bit. Dinner could be 5 minutes late, right? So we need to remind us, and that's why it's good to have teachers to remind us, to show us the way in this life. Yeah. Other questions or comments? Just could be spontaneous. Yes.
Forgive the self for not being there's opportunities where you know, oh yeah, I could probably help them.
Yeah.
But I have my agenda and
again, you know, we're in the cocoon of self. Right? We're in the cocoon of self. That's where we are. And we want to, you know, when you look at the cocoon, it's been a while since I've been in high school, so let me get this right. When you look at the cocoon, they all look sort of the same outside, but what's going on is what's going on inside, right? The transformation is going on inside, right? So we're all in the cocoon of self, in the cocoon of I, me, mine, right? That's the cocoon we're in. And why do we practice? To transform that, right? So we can break out, right? And become a butterfly. So along the way, probably from the moment we get up to the moment we go to bed, who are we going to encounter? Self, right? With its agenda, with its needs, with its wants, with its demands, right? With its issues. And that's what we practice, right? There's no other place to practice, right? I mean, if you asked a butterfly, gee, wouldn't you rather just be born a butterfly? You know, wouldn't that be easier? Right? Just be born a butterfly and just fly off in your beautiful colors. But it doesn't work that way, does it? They have to go through that whole other process. Being what? Like a caterpillar. Crawling around, eating somebody's tomato plants, you know. Risking being sprayed or picked off. Right? It's a whole process that caterpillar has to go through before it becomes a butterfly. And that's us. In Buddhism, we talk about the lotus in the mud. It's the great, the mud is the mud of our egocentricity, of our emotional afflictions, of all our stuff. And out of that mud, this beautiful lotus will grow, the lotus of enlightenment, the lotus of awakening, the lotus of all the positive virtues and characteristics. It's not going to grow anywhere else. The lotus only grows in the mud. Right? It doesn't grow in the air. And it's only through our own transformation of all that gunk, all that muck that's within us. And when we work with it, day after day, moment after moment, experience, you know, you right? You feel your heart, and yet your agenda, you know, and at that moment, just like the Lama said, at that moment, what do? Do you see it? Do you see your egocentricity? Do you see your annoyance? Do you see you're holding on? At that moment, if we are mindful, this is the moment to practice. There's no other moment. Right? We don't become selfless people, you know, by reading a book. Right? There are lots of books about selflessness, aren't there? You know, we don't become selfless by hearing talks about selflessness. We don't become selfless people by talking about selflessness. Right? Or imagining ourselves. Those are all just, you know, that just points us in the direction. But the direction has to be action, right? We have to, you know, a selfless person, there's no such thing as a selfless person. There are just people who, moment to moment, experience after experience, choose to act selflessly. When you add that all up, you say, oh, that's a selfless person. But there's no such thing as a selfless person, do you understand? There's no such thing as a self. All we are is a bundle of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, impulses, right, that are constantly arising moment to moment. So that's why, you know, what am I choosing in this moment? Do I choose altruism, or do I choose selfishness? And that choice goes on all day, doesn't it? Right, Liz? in this moment, do I choose myself or do I choose my kids? Now again, I can hear people going, but saying, oh, but shouldn't you also be taking care of yourself? And, of course. But, you know, not all the time. Yeah, and, you know, it's good to get a good night's sleep. But you don't have to sleep 12 hours a night, do you? You know, get enough sleep. You know, good, you know, get enough self-care so you can take care of others. But you may be surprised that being more altruistic, being more compassionate, being less self-absorbed actually makes yourself feel better. That's the research on altruism. Well, there's a lot of research. I mean, psychology is very interesting these days. I think some of it has to do with Buddhism coming to the West. Is that people are, there's like, I just got a book called Altruism by Matthew Ricard that's 700 pages. It's just a wonderful book. I mean, those you like, and it's all just full of the research. I mean, in all areas of science and psychology and sociology, just basically showing that there's actual proof, you know, that you know, altruism, compassion, kindness, all these thinking of others actually has a positive effects on human beings. These are happier people. So for those of us who need science, Alex Lerner, you're listening, right? This is the book for you. The proof is there. So good. So the kids are coming? Usually they come at 9:45. They're a little late. We have lots of fun. What? Maybe they're having too good a time. Any other comments on anybody wants to share? Can everybody hear, Lee?
A lot of irritation. And I finally got up enough courage to go to one of them and say, what do I do with this anger, this irritation? It's there all the time. And he looked at me and just this sweet little look and paused and he said, I haven't been angry in over 20 years. And, you know, it just continued that one comment. I couldn't go through a day without anger, and he hadn't been angry in 20 years, and that really moved me to the practice. And he directed me to Shantideva, chapter meditation. But he also said to me, when things don't go your way, notice
it.
And turn your attention somewhere else. Don't sit there and dwell and dwell. And I think it's so helpful these moments.
Yeah. So let me just repeat that for the recording. Aliza sharing her own experience of when she was practicing Dharma and still noticed she was very angry and irritated a lot. She went to see a Lama, and he said to her, "Oh, I have not been angry in 20 years." And Lee said that was just couldn't believe it, and